Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. Joining us now to tell us about municipal finance and green finance is Pat McCoy, finance director for the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority. He directs the issuance of over $3 billion in municipal bonds annually. Pat McCoy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're responsible for the MTA's $34 billion debt portfolio. How much of that would you like to see go into green bond initiatives?
Sure. Well, our debt outstanding is actually closer to $40 billion now. So, everything we do to move people around this city on electrified rail, be it the subways or commuter rails, is inherently green. And we've worked with the Climate Bonds Initiative to issue bonds labeled green. And as we continue to roll out our funding of our capital program through the issuance of bonds, I would expect that all of our transportation revenue bond or dedicated tax fund bond issues will be green.
Pat, do you ride the subway?
I do. I commute from Tarrytown and Westchester, so I take Metro North to Grand Central, and then I take the Lex Line down here to our office at 2 Broadway.
What project would you most like to see done next?
Well, you know, we have such a wide variety of projects that we're looking to fund. Clearly, the most critical are signalization in our subways to improve service there and to enable us to put more trains on the rails and move people around faster. That's a big project. It's not funded, and we're aggressively looking to put that program together and find funding.
How much would it cost?
The estimates are in the many billions. We don't have a firm estimate at this point. But it will be a very expensive project.
Now, you have a lot of experience dealing with the financing of a variety of projects, not only in your role as at the MTA, but also in previous roles. What can you tell people who might be skeptical about green bond initiatives, why you believe they work, and maybe explain a little bit about the attractiveness to the marketplace?
Sure. You know, the green bond space, in our view, is a natural fit to what the MTA is all about. As I said, but according to the Climate Bonds Initiative low carbon transport criteria, everything we do to move people on rails is green. That in and of itself is important, and I think the MTA needs to get recognition in the market for doing for undertaking activity that is inherently green.
But what does that mean when you say green?
Good question. So we estimate that every trip on public transportation saves or avoids about 10 pounds of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. Now, on an annualized basis, that's about a 19 million metric ton number.
Because the alternative is taking some kind of fossil fuel-based transport.
Exactly. So the alternative of people riding around in cars, typically one person, one car. So we avoid 19 million metric tons going into the atmosphere every year. We spend about 2 million metric tons to provide the service that we do. So the net benefit of 17 million metric tons avoided is inherently good for our region, for our state, and for the economy.
When you said that the total debt load right now is $40 billion, I imagine it would climb considerably if all the projects you would like to see done actually get okayed and the sign-off. We had Richard Ravitch, the former Lieutenant Governor of New York, on our program a couple months ago, and he said, you know, the MTA hasn't conducted a thorough study of even what would be required to fix the subways and exactly what the costs would be. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for Dick. He's a friend, and I think he is a wonderful spokesperson for infrastructure generally. What I'll say is that we're in the throes of working on what we call our 20-year needs assessment, which essentially mandates that all of our agencies, transit authority, the railroads, bridges and tunnels, undertake a really thorough top-to-bottom review of all of our infrastructure needs that will inform how we put together our next capital program, and that will be the 2020 to 2024 capital program. It will be a 5-year capital program. Our current program, the 15 to 19 period, is $33.5 billion. So, you know, I don't want to say Dick's off base on this. What I would say is that, you know, we're coming up with a new 20-year needs assessment that's going to really lay out what those critical priorities are for the coming capital investment cycle.
How much of that $33 billion or so would be financed through the bond market versus through state or city funding?
Sure. So bonds are an important funding component to the capital programs, but not the only thing we rely on. The cornerstone of our capital investment cycle is the federal government through participation in the 5307 and the 5309, the formula programs, the new starts program, for example, for Second Avenue Subway. And then, of course, the state and the city kick in. So bonds have typically been in that, about a third to, 40%. It varies. You know, it varies by program, by revenue sources the state can identify for us to lever. But it will be an important piece of the picture.
All right. Which train line is going to get renovated next that hasn't been announced?
I wish I could tell you. I don't know.
You're looking at it. 116th station of the C. I think that's next. And
okay.
I'm very excited about that. Pat McCoy.
Great.
Pat McCoy, Finance Director for the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority.
I sense a plaque.
Yeah, that was
in a lot of public venues, like benches in Central Park, you can get someone to sponsor a train station.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. I've spent a lot of my life in train stations. Yeah. Pat McCoy, thank you again for joining us.
All right. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We are here, we are very lucky to say, with the chief executive and the chairman of Build America Mutual, Sean McCarthy and Bob Cochran. And, it's interesting. We've seen a number of stories about unprecedented outflows from a few municipal bond funds. We've seen rates rise just across the board as benchmarks rise. And certainly it's the same story for municipal bonds. And I want to start with Sean. What does this mean for municipalities that are hoping to finance infrastructure projects or anything else through the municipal bond market? How are they dealing with or planning around the increasing rates we've seen?
So it's interesting. Two points. The first is that interest rates are rising because the economy is strong. And one thing to look at is what is the revenue strength or stream that state and local governments have right now. And if we look at that over the past year, it's increased by 6.7%. So the capacity for municipalities to actually issue debt for new money has increased
Hold
over
on
the
one
last
second.
Year.
Because it's really interesting that you say that. I'm just thinking to myself, is it even across the board, or are there certain areas that have actually seen their tax revenues increase dramatically while other places have seen them decline?
I'd say generally it's increased in some places quite
so
a bit more.
Okay.
As the economy's increased, interest rates have gone up, and generally that capacity for state and local governments has increased. So if you look at it this year, actually, there's been a 14% increase in spending by state and local governments on infrastructure. So that's a total of $293 billion in construction, and that would be an increase of $36 billion. So it's not insignificant.
Bob Cochran, I'm wondering if you could just step back for a second and describe why you and Sean decided to start this firm. Mm-hmm. You both worked at FSA. That was acquired by Assured. Right. What makes Build America, BAM, different, not only in its ownership structure, but in the kinds of municipal debt that it underwrites, that it guarantees, rather.
Right. So Sean and I got together. We had, we've been together as business partners for over 30 years, even prior to FSA.
35 if we're counting.
Right. Bills.
And 3 days. And
bills
and
up
four
after
hours.
A while. So we had a lot of experience in the industry. We have a love of the industry and a lot of the people that work in it. We took a couple of years off, and as you know, through the financial crisis, most of the companies didn't make it. We tried to assess what we thought were the causes and results of that, and could we build a better company, a better business model that would address what we thought were the problems that led to some of the failures in 2008-09. And Build America Mutual was a result of that collaboration. We spent almost 2 years sort of working through that plan and raising the capital to start the company. And BAM is a mutual insurance company, I think probably the first one created in New York in at least 40 or 50 years. And the reason we did that is so that the issuers, the public entities that use insurance, would essentially be our shareholders, our members. And the reason for that is we're not driven by high returns on equity. We're driven by high accumulation of capital and the safety of the bonds that we insure for investors.
So, Sean, given that, and given that it's been a really benevolent backdrop to issue debt over the past 8 years, 10 years, why is there this impression that a lot of local and state municipalities have declined to issue debt to pay for big infrastructure projects? Why are we hearing this push about the need for a whole rebuilding of American infrastructure?
Well, it's a good question. First and foremost, remember that state and local governments represent 90% of the financing for infrastructure in the nation. So when people think, has the federal government passed a bill that's going to finance state and local governments, infrastructure in the country, it's really state and local governments that are doing that. They are really the engine behind infrastructure finance. The thing I mentioned before is directly related to that, and that is the fact that municipalities, their revenue strength has been increasing since the recession. That happens gradually as tax bases grow, real estate values increase, and that enables municipalities to then commit to new projects when things are in a recession. They actually are trying to claw back and make sure that they keep themselves in a fiscally sound position. So it's interesting for BAM, because as a mutual insurance company, we do a number of things that are unique. One is that we provide credit profiles. A financial description of each credit that we do, we update it every year. It's available for free on our website. And part of a logical outgrowth of that is our Green Star program. So the speaker before us, Andrew Wiley, was talking about green bonds. What we've recently launched is an examination within the credit analysis we already do on each credit. About 20% of the credits that we analyze will qualify as green bonds into the market. So we think that over the near and long term will be help the market understand and expand the green bond initiative, which really comes down to environmental and climate appropriate bonds, water treatment, water purification.
Renewable
energy, exactly. Mm-hmm. And all those things, I think, pair up very well with what BAM does. You know, right now, we've been in writing business for 6 years. Comprises $53 billion worth of municipal bonds for 6,500 different issuers. So when you said, what's different about what we do? One of the things that's different is we are looking at sort of core municipal finance. So general obligation bonds, revenue bonds from taxes. It's really straight down the middle of the fairway in terms of what is classically municipal finance. And for the investing market, that's important because they can look at us as ultimate transparency, look at every credit on our website, look at the financial strength of our AA from Standard & Poor's, and look at our commitment as being the only muni-only municipal guarantor. So if you think about it in those terms, what happened in the crisis? It wasn't municipal bonds that defaulted en masse. It was other things that happened. And BAM's committed to the fact that we only do municipal finance. And the core of that business is state and local governments. They're the engine behind the growth and rehabilitation of infrastructure in the market. And finally, if you just think about what's the demand, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers has projected a $200 billion need for additional financing over the next 10 years. In infrastructure.
And just real quickly, in 30 seconds, do you think that that's going to be difficult to finance given the fact that rates are rising more and potentially the credit cycle could turn?
Well, first of all, Sean, that's $200 billion a year more, so $2 trillion over the next 10 years that we have to increase. Interest rates are definitely a factor because if we're going to achieve that kind of funding rate over and above what the municipal market is already achieving, which is about $250 billion a year in new money financing. It's got to be financed with some sort of long-term debt, municipal bonds, and it's got to be paid back over time with the revenue stream.
Thanks very much, gentlemen. Bob Cochran, Chairman, Build America Mutual. Sean McCarthy, Chief Executive Officer, Build America Mutual.
we are focusing today on Caterpillar, which has been a bellwether of global growth. And today, that bellwether is not signaling something positive. Joining us now is Brooke Sutherland, Bloomberg Opinion Industrials columnist. And Brooke, I'm just wondering, I mean, Caterpillar didn't boost its outlook for the year, which analysts had expected. But was it really so bad, this report, or are investors simply looking for the negative right now because they're feeling skittish and are looking to take profits right now?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think what's really key to keep in mind here is that nobody's saying that growth is all of a sudden going to stop and we're going to start to see sales decline at these industrial companies. It's all about where the momentum is heading. And I think what Caterpillar's report indicated is that the sales momentum is slowing. So you're still going to see growth, but you're probably not going to see it at the rates that we had been seeing. Now, part of that is just lapping tougher comparisons, but there's also questions about how demand is going to hold up in some of these markets. And as Caterpillar pushes through price increases to offset some of these rising raw material costs amid the trade war, you know, could that ultimately affect demand and sort of accelerate the growth slowdown that we're already seeing naturally as we get later in the economic cycle?
Brooke, if you happen to be a company that is buying or leasing a Caterpillar, let's say, off-highway truck, you know, in the mining industry or construction business, those items, they're like $3.5 million just for the one-time purchase. If you're financing it, things are going to get more expensive. If you're buying it, raw material inputs are making it more expensive. What has happened in 3 months? How come we didn't hear this 3 months ago in the last earnings report?
You know, I think we did. I think this price cost headwind has been a matter of debate for the bulk of this year as, you know, people sort of digest the tariffs, and especially as the tariff actions have escalated. I think the big question is how companies are going to be handling this. And you make a good point that, you know, if Caterpillar raises its prices, those customers are also seeing rising costs on their end. So their ability to absorb those price increases is really gets to the heart of what the issue is here, is are they willing to tolerate that and continue buying equipment, or do they just, you know, decide to hold off on some of these replacement purchases or especially new equipment purchases?
Do we get a sense of which industries were the most positive for Caterpillar and which were the most negative? In other words, are there sectors of their business that are doing better or worse?
Yeah, so they also reported their September sales on Monday night, and that's on a three-month rolling average basis. And what you saw there was a slight slowdown in construction equipment sales growth. And that was offset by, you know, pretty strong momentum in its mining segment, which makes sense because mining is coming back from a pretty severe downturn. But you are seeing a little bit of that weakness in construction, and sort of you couple that with a lot of the negative sentiment that we've been hearing for home builder stocks and for, you know, construction in general. And I think that is definitely something that investors are picking up on today.
Well, and that's actually a really interesting point. I was going to go to that. I mean, does this signal something broader about the slowdown in the home building sector and just sort of in general about some of the industries that have supported the recovery so far really slowing down and perhaps in even more meaningful way than people have realized?
I think, you know, a lot of what you're seeing is sort of coming up on the peak in the cycle, and that affects companies in different ways. So 3M also reported today, and its stock is getting crushed. And a lot of the slowdown that it saw is in these shorter cycle markets. So automotive, electronics, healthcare as well. And some of those have had stronger momentum for a longer stretch of time. And I would also put residential construction, home building in that. They've been on this recovery track for a longer period. And so it makes sense that we might be nearing the peak of that versus some of these longer cycle businesses. Like I think of United Technologies, which is also out today, and its aerospace business. I mean, it takes those orders very far in advance. You don't just show up at United Technologies and buy a jet engine. So those backlogs, those order rates should help United Technologies and companies in those later cycle businesses maintain momentum through 2019. But as you sort of look at these dynamics, I think you can read into some of the trends we're seeing at the shorter cycle companies that we might be nearer a turning point than not.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Brooke Sutherland, of course, expert in all things having to do with mergers, acquisitions, and just general corporate Go ahead.
Something really strange, because as Brooke is talking about home builders and how there has been this slowdown, Toll Brothers, one of the biggest home builders, their shares are up today, nearly 2%. So go figure. There actually is some strength today in home builders, even though there is a generally negative sentiment. And frankly, home builder stocks, as Dave Wilson has pointed out in his chart of the day, actually have entered a bear market. So perhaps some people are seeing some opportunities.
President Donald Trump is set to meet with the Chinese President Xi Jinping at the Group of 20 Nations Summit in Buenos Aires. The topic, of course, is going to be trade disputes. And the information comes from the White House economic advisor, Larry Kudlow. And here to tell us more about the dispute and whether it presents some opportunities is John Authors of Bloomberg Opinion. John, welcome as always. And as the senior markets editor for Bloomberg, I wonder if you could just describe emerging markets. Does China still count as an emerging market?
Yes. I mean, to some extent, there's still an argument about whether it's even as far as emerging, given that it still doesn't open its markets as freely to the outside world as it should. That's why we've had the annual excitement over whether MSCI is going to, the index group that largely controls the description of emerging markets, whether MSCI is going to be including Chinese A shares in its index. But it doesn't really matter terribly which measure of China you take at the moment. They're all down quite badly over the last 6 months. Yeah.
John, first of all, I want to just welcome you to Bloomberg because you spent nearly 30 years at the Financial Times in a variety of positions, and it is a coup for us that you joined us. So I just want to say congratulations and welcome. We're thrilled.
That's very nice of you. Thanks.
John, I want to just take a step back and look at the broader sell-off today in markets, and on a certain level, it's almost comforting. And I'll tell you why, because you're not seeing bonds and stocks sell off in tandem. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, do you think that this is actually somewhat more predictable, that basically this is the market more broadly saying to the Federal Reserve, slow down, growth is going to slow going forward, higher input costs are going to weigh on companies, and things are just going to take a breather for a minute? I mean, is that the interpretation here?
That's one interpretation of it, certainly, and not necessarily an unreasonable one. Another way of looking at it, which would be relatively healthy, although it would suggest that the president might have been a little unwise to make the stock market such a measure of his success, is that we might finally be getting to the long-awaited point when Main Street gains somewhat at the expense of Wall Street, that you're seeing a number of the companies that have disappointed on earnings have cited the problems of rising costs, including labor costs. Obviously, that's good news for the very many, very frustrated people here in the US who have suffered sluggish wage growth for a long time. Similarly, as the economy strengthens and rates go up, that makes it harder sledding to make money out of the stock market, but it suggests that there is more genuine, robust health out here. So to some extent, this is what had been hoped for a while. You could argue, yes, that it's a healthy form of growth. The problem, there is a problem. The problem probably arises with, as we mentioned earlier, what exactly is going on in China. We're in a bipolar world in many senses in the moment. There are two economies that count, the US and China. And some of the things that are happening in China cannot be ascribed merely to trade tensions, which are yet seriously to bite, and they plainly are concerning.
John, you're famous for taking the long view. If you're an investor that takes the long view, where would you be telling people to look for prospective assets to purchase?
Somewhere other than the U.S., more or less anywhere other than the U.S., frankly. I mean, in terms of, in the very long term, it's very hard to dispute the notion that the single most important factor in the return you'll get in the end is how much you paid for it at the start. There are almost no stock markets out there that look particularly expensive other than the US, which I've been in various arguments with people now that my email is starting to regularly go out from Bloomberg. And so Bloomberg readers are discovering that I think U.S. stocks are overpriced. My beloved FT readers have known that for a while. U.S. stocks are plainly overpriced. If you don't believe it, send me an email and I'll try to convince you otherwise.
Well done.
But outside of the U.S., most of the world has interesting characteristics to it. You can certainly argue whether some of the more apparently cheap markets are value traps. The fact that the cheapest mainstream stock market at the moment is Russia does tell you something about why it might be cheap right there. But outside the US, there are interesting opportunities.
So is Italy interesting? Or is it selling off for a reason?
Italy is fascinating. I would even say it's very entertaining.
You have to be entertaining though in 30 seconds.
Cause no. Italy, if you want to try to be clever and make an opportunistic buy, don't do it now in Italy, because I don't see a way in which this political standoff is resolved quickly. This isn't Greece. The Italians really can try to call the Europeans bluff, and the Europeans really can't bring the kind of leverage against Italy that they used against Greece, but the bond market can. So this is not the time to dive in yet, unless you really feel like you might, like Mega Millions, it might work out for you, but I wouldn't recommend it.
It might be trying to get the jackpot for the $1.6 billion pool that's out there for the lottery that nobody has won yet. John Authors, Senior Markets Editor for Bloomberg. We welcome him to Bloomberg. We're thrilled that he has joined us. We really appreciate you joining us right now.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.